Okay, thank you very much. All right, we're going to go on to our third case of the day. That is number 211168, Kendall and Jackson versus the Illinois Department of Commerce. Hello, Mr. Baker.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I please the court, Mr. Rush? My name is John Baker, and I represent the appellant Kendall and Jackson in this proceeding. We are here today to ask the court to reverse a grant of summary judgment, and I think I need to clear something up initially. When we filed our complaint, we did name the department as a defendant, but that was on an Illinois Ethics Act claim. We are not pursuing that here on appeal today. So the defendants are the two individual defendants on the 1983 claims that we are here for today. So even though the title has the department in it, they are technically, I think, not a part of these proceedings. Kendall and Jackson worked for the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity for a number of years. In 2016, she received multiple performance evaluations all at the same time for three specific terms. When she received those evaluations, they were fairly average, but the last one gave her objectives for the previous year and told her what her objectives were. 1 month later, she receives an evaluation, and that evaluation evaluated her on the objectives that she had never received. And the evaluation was about as bad as an evaluation can be for a governmental employee. It had every, I think, 8 of 9 categories were rated as unacceptable. Illinois law is pretty clear that personnel evaluations serve a very important point. And in our brief, we've outlined what the state of Illinois uses evaluations for and the process and what they are supposed to be used for. There's an interactive process between the employee and their supervisor to go over this so that an employee has an understanding of what is expected of them, and then that they can work towards satisfying those expectations. Here, there's no question, everyone acknowledges, Jackson could not have met her objectives because they were never given to her, and she didn't know what they were. And so she gets this evaluation. About 3 weeks later, she is notified that she is going to be suspended for a period of 7 days. And there were two charges that were brought against her to support that disciplinary action. The first of those, and again, these are detailed in both sides' briefs, but that she engaged in unprofessional conduct when she spoke with a customer. The second one was that she used unprofessional behavior with her supervisor. Now, Kendall and Jackson, the testimony on those two points came from two people, Ms. Jackson's supervisor and Ms. Jackson. They both paint very, very different views of what happened in both of those situations.
And when you are discussing that, if you would be kind enough, Mr. Baker, to please help us out by discussing what record evidence there is to support the inference that either of the two adverse employment actions that you, you know, have identified can be linked to Ms. Jackson's race or gender. Is it just the come here incident and the girl reference, or is there more that is in the record?
I believe that there is, Your Honor. For starters, there is a divergence here from what state policy is supposed to be. The protocol of the state of Illinois is that these evaluations are supposed to serve a purpose, and they don't. And so this court has ruled in a number of different cases that when an employer abandons its policies and procedures, that can create an inference of a discriminatory motive. So that's one piece. The statements, the referring to her as a girl, and again, Kendall and Jackson's description of the way that she was treated by Mr. Denny, very, very different than Mr. Denny's descriptions of that. You know, he says he was just pointing to a sign out of seat. She says he's yelling, pointing to her in a very derogatory fashion to come sit down. Those are two very different things, and I think that the inferences that can be drawn there are that those were quite derogatory. Once Ms. Jackson attempted to speak to her supervisors about her evaluation, she was told to leave the room and not talk to them about it. And you know, if you look at there's no direct evidence. There's nothing that says this was race, this was gender. And we did not use the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting methodology. That's correct. But when you look at the totality of the circumstances, and I think particularly with the 7-day suspension, you know, when you combine the performance evaluations with that, and when you look at the pattern of improper treatment, I believe that there is an inference there that can be drawn.
Certainly have identified a range of behaviors that are consistent with the notion that she was being undermined, maybe isolated and treated unfairly in the workplace. I mean, I'm going to grant you that. But that doesn't necessarily show us that the source of the animus was her race or gender. And that's what I'm looking for.
Tell me, is it your understanding of your burden here to show that there are facts from which a jury can infer that race or gender was really the reason for her suspension?
Well, I think that's absolutely.
Or do you have the option, alternative, of showing that there are facts from which a jury can infer that her supervisors were lying about their reason for her suspension? That was pretext. Do you understand?
I do, and I think both of those actually fall together. First of all, is our standard of proof, and the question is, would a jury, looking at all of this evidence, be allowed to permissibly infer that there was discriminatory animus here? So that's our standard. The question is, when you look at a employer who is giving phony answers and false answers and deviating from the policies and procedures that are set out by, in this case, Illinois law, that suggests that the justifications that they're providing are not accurate.
What's the record evidence of the phony or false answers?
Well, I think that when you look at the evaluations, they have said that these were accurate. They were not. We have a lengthy record disputing what was said in there. But even more importantly, when you go to the suspension, the justifications that were used for the suspension are based on facts. Denny says that Ms. Jackson was very, very rude to him. She was assertive. She was loud. She was yelling at him. She was belligerent, pointing at him. She disagrees with that. She says, no, I was very calm. I approached it in a very reasonable and professional manner. So here we have two separate facts. The district court looked at that and said, well, those are just two different interpretations of the facts. Well, we're entitled, I think, because we're the ones, the non-moving party, to the inferences to be drawn in our favor. And we have to accept the facts that are being offered by Ms. Jackson to the extent that they diverge from those of Mr. Denny. So if we accept Ms. Jackson's facts on that, it shows that they're not being truthful about the justifications that they are utilizing for the suspension that they handed down for her. So I think that becomes a divergence and not necessarily being truthful in their justifications for why they did what they did. I know I'm down to about a minute. Previous counsel said time flies, and it certainly does when you're up here. So I will, if I could, save the remainder for my rebuttal time, unless the court has any more questions.
No. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Rush. Hello, Mr. Rush.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Caleb Rush, appearing for defendants, appellees, Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, Victor Neurosis, and Ben Denny. We're asking the court to affirm the grant of summary judgment based on well-established principles. First and foremost, that a plaintiff claiming employment discrimination must produce evidence that she suffered an adverse employment action because of her membership in a protected category, gender or race, in this case. We're not talking about a mere violation of a policy. A mere violation of a policy is not a constitutional violation. The cases that talk about violation of policies also involve additional evidence pointing to discrimination, such as internal inconsistencies, self-contradictions by the employer, or differential treatment, none of which we have record.
We have suspension without pay here.
We do have a suspension without pay, and we acknowledge that that is an adverse employment action because, unlike the evaluations, you know, that's a concrete harm. It's a week without pay. But the problem with the reason why that does not add up to a discrimination claim that can survive summary judgment is with that and with the evaluations, there's no record evidence pointing to race or gender as a factor.
Tell me this, with respect to that suspension, if we were to assume the truth of Ms. Jackson's assertion that she wasn't rude or aggressive or yelling or unprofessional with either Mr. Rothart or Mr. Denny, then why does that not support an inference that the defendants didn't honestly believe she was rude and so forth? I mean, I understand that different people can have different subjective perceptions of the same behavior, but this is summary judgment. How would a plaintiff ever get to trial if the defendant can always say, well, I honestly thought she was shouting, even if she said she wasn't shouting, and you can't prove that I didn't think so?
Thank you, Judge, for the question. I appreciate it. It gives me an opportunity to correct a matter stated by opposing counsel just a few minutes ago. Judge, I agree. The question is the employer's honest belief. The decision makers on the suspension did not include Mr. Denny, who is alleged to have made these comments, which I will note did not specifically involve race or gender or another protected category. But at any rate, Mr. Denny was not one of the decision makers. The decision makers were Mr. Neurosis, Human Resources, the director's office. And as you said, Judge, the question is, what is the decision maker's honest belief? Here is where their honest belief came from. Starting in 2015, Neurosis heard from the general counsel and from someone in the director's office, that was Emily Monk, raising concerns about Jackson's timeliness, accuracy, and comportment. Then we have other people in the business development office, Melody Sanderfield, who is sometimes referred to as Melody Wilson in the deposition testimony, and Mark Gauss, concerned for their safety around Jackson. These are reported to Neurosis. Mark Gauss also reported to HR and maybe also to Neurosis about Jackson verbally abusing a temporary employee named Ashley Wonderling. We have an email from Misha Fisher, who was previously in the director's office, to Neurosis, talking about interns being aware of difficulties working with Jackson.
But when Ms. Jackson is suspended for 7 days without pay, the grounds specifically asserted were that she was rude and loud and yelling on this call with Rothbert, and two, that she was agitated and unprofessional in her response to this memorandum that was edited by the legal department. the grounds for the suspension did not refer back to these other pieces of information that you are providing now.
The pre-disciplinary notice did refer, and I think this might have been document 20-9, did refer to a consistent pattern of unprofessional behavior. Not only that, but when the decision makers are assessing these two catalyst incidents, and I absolutely agree, the two incidents in October were the catalysts for the suspension. But when the decision makers are making a decision about this suspension without pay for a week, they're entitled to consider the full facts that they've been made aware of over the course of Ms. Jackson's employment. And here's a key point that I want to clarify. They, on these incidents, they were not just dealing with Ms. Jackson versus Mr. Denny. They were dealing with, on the one incident, Denny and Mr. Rothart's communication to Neurosis about this phone call. And then on the other incident, we had John Glazier and Matt Jennings both telling Neurosis this is the conversation about the edited memo, that describing Jackson as rude and uncontrollable, and they said that her behavior created a hostile work environment. So even on those two incidents, it was not just two witnesses, a he said, she said. Of course, they also heard previous concerns from the IT department, and the head of IT asked not for his people to have to work with Jackson at all. And then there was also the email from the temp staffing agency, the manager there, a gentleman named Rick Lenhart, talking about a different temporary, Joyce Lawrence, different temporary employee from the one previously reported as suffering verbal abuse.
Are you saying there's no factual dispute at all, or just that you all have more facts?
Neither. I'm saying that the question before this court is the decision maker's honest belief, and the question, and so it's not, it's the issue before this court is not whether there was some factual dispute, it's whether there was a material factual dispute. For instance, in the Widmar case cited in our brief, there can be all kinds of factual disputes, but they have to be material. And we don't have evidence on the record showing that these decision makers did not honestly believe that they concluded that Ms. Jackson was behaving in an unprofessional way. And I want to mention a few other reasons why the connection to Mr. Denny is particularly attenuated. First of all, the actual deposition testimony about Mr. Denny's statements does not lead to a reasonable inference of race-based or gender-based animus. We have testimony that in a hostile or derogatory tone, he tells her to come here and he points down. We have, and then about the girl comment, she says she doesn't even remember it, but it may have been Denny. But even if we assume that these things happened the way that that Jackson says in the briefs, then we have a problem that they're not connected to the time of the adverse action. They're not connected to the process of the adverse action. Denny wasn't a decision maker. There's no attempt to lay out a cat's paw theory, which couldn't work anyway because these decision makers didn't singularly or wholly depend on Denny's accounts. So the situation with Denny is very attenuated. One way to consider it is, does the Seventh Circuit want to shift from established precedent and have a federal district court trial on discrimination claims every time an employer who is a decision maker points at a subordinate and says, come here, and points down? Or 6 months before a decision calls a subordinate a boy or a girl. you know, we certainly aren't suggesting that that's appropriate workplace conduct, but it, but there's no case suggesting that that's a violation of a constitutional right or gives rise to an employment discrimination claim. With that, I'll rest on our briefs if the court doesn't have any further questions, and we will ask the court to affirm the grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rush. Mr. Baker, let's give Mr. Baker 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do appreciate the extra time. I just want to briefly touch upon Mr. Denny. Mr. Denny was her supervisor. He became her supervisor right when these evaluations came out, right when she was suspended. And this is a 1983 claim. It's not a Title VII claim. Mr. Denny is an individual defendant. And when an individual causes a deprivation, they can be liable under 1983. This is not a Title VII claim. So the question of Mr. Denny's involvement, while it might not go to the ultimate decision makers, he's the one who was providing and feeding this information to the ultimate decision maker. So his liability is still there. The other thing that I think is striking, they make this whole case about all these horrible things that Kendall and Jackson supposedly did. People felt like she was in danger. They were in jeopardy around her. That's problematic because why wasn't she ever disciplined for those things? Why weren't those things ever addressed? I mean, if she's the way they have spun it is that she was absolutely the worst employee in the history of the department, but yet there's nothing that's ever done about that. They said that Mr. Nerussa said he began discussing her demeanor with her in 2015. She filed an affidavit and she said, I had one meeting with Mr. Nerussa and Emily Monk in 2015. They told me that they had heard negative things about me. I told him that was the first I had ever heard about that. Being concerned and wanting to take corrective action, I asked Mr. Nerussa for details so that I could learn from my allegedly deficient behavior and prevent it from recurring in the future. Mr. Nerussa failed to provide me with any information that supports this contention. So again, where is the communication? Where is this information that she was supposedly this horribly deficient person? We have these issues that all occur right when Mr. Denny becomes her supervisor in 2016, these evaluations and then the suspension. And for those reasons, and I understand what Mr. Rush is saying, the court doesn't want to go to a point that anytime an employer points to the ground that there's a trial, but that is evidence. And if that were the only piece of evidence, we probably wouldn't be here. But it's not the only piece of evidence. There's this systematic abandonment of the policies on how to handle these evaluations. Those are significant things, and the question becomes really, can a jury, based upon the facts, permissibly infer that there was discriminatory intent? That's really what the question is, and we believe that there is sufficient evidence for that, and we would ask the court to reverse and remand this matter for trial. If there are no other questions, I'll step aside. Thank you.
And we thank you very much. The case is going to be taken under advisement.